Welcome to Oslo International Church's podcast, where we share weekly reflections from our community of faith. If you'd like to explore more of our resources or join us for a service, visit our website at oslointernational.church. And now, here's the message from our last Sunday service with Pastor Maikon Stornagel.
Don't you just love a bureaucratic loop? Have you ever found yourself in one of those? A bureaucracy loop? I'm sure you have. It's horrible to be caught in one. It's horrible. And annoying in the best cases and kind of infuriating in the worst ones. But from the comfort of distance, they can be quite amusing once we're past them, right? One of my favorite ones from my own experience is this one. We had just arrived in Norway many years ago, and we were going through the whole process of getting our paperwork in order, right? Some of you are already like, oh, you know what that's like, right? And we're going through the whole process of getting our paperwork in order. And of course, the most important thing that you need to get in order is your social security number, or personal number, as we often call it, right? Your fødselsnummer. You need that. Without it, it is exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, to get anything done. From banking, to health, to school, and also, of course, the postal service. So we're at the government office thing, all happy and satisfied because we're finishing the process, and the guy behind the counter says, "That's it, you're all done. Now you just need to wait for the ID papers to arrive by mail, and you're good to go." And I'm ready to celebrate. And then the guy goes, "Just make sure you're registered to the address or else the postal service will not deliver your letter." And I go, "Okay, how do I do that?" To which he answers, "Well, you just go to a postal office." They still had those back then. Or you register in the website using your personal number. You mean the personal number that I'm supposed to get by mail? The one I'm supposed to get in the letter that the postal service will not deliver unless I have registered to my address with the number that is in the letter that I won't receive because I don't have the number to register to the address so that I can get the number in order to register or receive it, which I won't because I have it. Welcome to the loop. Right? Welcome to the loop. You're stuck in it for eternity. And soon enough, you find yourself just staring into emptiness and asking, "Who am I? Where's my identity?" Right? Who am I? And your identity is lost in this circular logic of bureaucratic affairs. That's what I call a bureaucratic loop. I did figure that one out eventually. I'm still here and I'm legal. I did figure that one out, and I managed to get my ID. But at that moment, all I could think of asking was, "Well, what exactly do you want me to do here? Right? What are you expecting from me? How do I get myself out of this loop?" After reading the text we have for this Sunday service, for this Sunday reflection of today, we might find ourselves asking that same question and feeling like we're stuck in a loop. And I want to read it with you. The text that we have for today is from the Gospel according to St. Mark, and it's in chapter 8. I'm going to read from the NRSV translation. So if you're going to follow it in your own scripture, sometimes there are some variations there in translations, but the story is the same. Gospel according to St. Mark, chapter 8, from verses 27 to 38. And this is what the Gospel writer Mark tells us. "Jesus went on with his disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, 'Who do people say that I am?' And they answered him, 'John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets.' He asked them, 'But who do you say that I am?' I answered him, 'You are the Messiah.' And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called a crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." That's how Gospel writer Mark tells us the story. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. So, what am I supposed to do here? If I want to save my life, I will lose it. But if I lose it for the sake of the gospel, I am saving it. But then, aren't I choosing to lose it only because I want to save it anyway? Welcome to the loop. You're stuck in it for eternity. No, hopefully not. But I'll get back to that. First, I want to say something else that I find is quite important when we talk about this passage. And that is that if you find this hard to understand, if you find this confusing, you're in good company. You're in good company. Not just in each other's company here this afternoon, but also in good biblical company. In fact, I would say welcome to the company of the disciples, because they not only struggle to understand this, but in the gospel according to Mark, they seem to not understand anything. They seem to not understand a single thing. They don't understand Jesus' parables, and they keep on asking him to explain it to them. They don't understand his miracles and keep on underestimating his power and awareness of them. They don't understand the way Jesus interprets the law, and they keep on asking him to spell it out for them again and again. In the Gospel of Mark, the general rule is that the disciples don't get it. Whatever Jesus says or does, they don't get it. And it's not so much that Mark is wanting to make the disciples look bad, even though I do think there is reason to argue that he might purposefully be making sure that they don't look too good, so that the early church doesn't sort of develop a celebrity cult around the disciples, which apparently was a thing before social media already. But that's not what's going on in the text, right? There's some conjecture to that argument. But looking at the literary aspects of the gospel itself, there is something else going on here. The disciples' confusion and their misunderstandings, they play a narrative role in the Gospel of Mark, and they play a theological role in how he's telling the story. So part of what their constant not understanding is doing is that it is playing along with a quite strong element of Mark's gospel telling that theologians call the messianic mystery. And we don't have time to dwell on this at length, but essentially it is this thing in a narrative where you see Jesus actively telling people not to share who he is. And we saw it just now in the text, right? So he heals someone and he says, "Don't tell anyone." He makes a great claim about himself and then he says, "Don't tell anyone." And this keeps on happening. He's telling also even these demonic entities that are recognizing him to be quiet and not declare him to be who he is. And this element, it is stronger in the beginning of the narrative, in the gospel. And as the gospel of Mark progresses, Jesus' identity as the Messiah becomes gradually more and more public, more and more explicit, until it leads us to the cross. And that dynamic of Mark's gospel telling, this section that we find today, and especially this chapter that is surrounding it, chapter 8, it plays a pivotal role in the storytelling. And central to that shift, it's when it starts shifting towards slowly being more and more public and less of this mystery. And central to that shift is Peter's answer to Jesus' question, who do you say I am? Who do you say I am? You are the Messiah. And we want to say yes. Finally, they get one right. Except not really. Not really. Peter sees who Jesus is, but his perception, his vision, his understanding is blurred. And Mark is a skillful storyteller. And if we had been reading all along, we have these cuts, right, when we're preaching, but if we had been reading all along, Mark had prepared us for Peter's confusion. And he had prepared us with a rather unusual story of healing. There's several stories of healing throughout the Gospels, and in the Gospel of Mark, this is a rather unusual one. And it's the text right before, and I want to read it for you. It's from 22. You don't have to put it up. I'll just tell it. From verse 22 to 26, this is what Mark says. This is right before. They came to Bethsaida. Some people brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village, so away from the people. And when he had put saliva on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Can you see anything?" And the man looked up and said, "I can see people, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he looked intently, and his sight was restored. And he saw everything clearly. Then Jesus sent him away to his home, saying, do not even go into the village. Can you see anything? Who do you say that I am? Can you see anything? Multiple other times, as I said, Jesus had healed people, and he hadn't asked them if it worked. He just says a word, and it's done. But here Jesus asks. Jesus asks so that Mark can tell us that this man who had his life transformed by Jesus at first could see something he didn't see before, but he needed more time with Jesus in order to see clearly. He needed more of the touch of Jesus in order to see clearly, and he needed to look intently to sort out what he was looking at. Right? And Mark goes, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Take this with you. Remember it, right? Mark wants us to carry this image with us into the conversation he was about to have. Right? The conversation where Peter gets it right, but not really. Can you see anything? Who do you say that I am? As soon as Peter declares to Jesus, "You are the Messiah, the anointed one of God." That's what Messiah means. Christ, Messiah, it's the Hebrew and the Greek expression for the anointed one of God. As soon as Peter declares Jesus to be the chosen one of God, the anointed one of God, Jesus starts telling his disciples about what would happen to him. That he would be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. And Mark tells us that he doesn't sugarcoat it. He says that Jesus spoke plainly about this. And Peter, who had just declared Jesus to be the Messiah, calls Jesus aside and rebukes him for predicting his death. And Jesus' reaction is stark, right? "Get behind me, Satan." Satan is a word that means the accuser. "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Nowhere else in the Bible does Jesus have such strong words of rebuke for his disciples. So what did Peter get wrong this time? Like, isn't Jesus the Messiah after all? Oh, yes, he was, but not the Messiah that Peter, at this point, envisioned him to be. It's like Peter was pointing to people and arguing with Jesus that those were, in fact, walking trees. He's looking in the right direction. He's seeing the right movement, but his vision is blurred. And he needs more time with Jesus. The issue isn't that the disciples fail to recognize Jesus as the Messiah. The issue is that they struggle to understand what that means, what an incarnate God Messiah was about. So Jesus goes on about on the work of clearing their understanding, of touching their eyes with more of his words and explaining to them and trying to open up for them what it means to follow him, the incarnate Messiah. Because for Peter, the whole death thing, it seems completely un-Christ-like, un-Messiah-like. And now Jesus is telling them that the cross, that death, is precisely the way of the Messiah and of those who follow him. And that the thing is, that seems obvious to us. To us who have crosses in our churches and have associated a cross with Christianity for ages. So we often assume that we know what Peter still didn't. If we bother giving him that much grace, right? That we know what Peter didn't. That we can see clearly because we know how Easter goes, how crucifixion goes, and how resurrection goes. But are we really seeing that clearly? I think it's hard for us to get just how absurd this notion of the Messiah dying on a cross was for Peter and for the disciples. A cross wasn't just death. Cross was humiliation. It was shame. It was a public stripping of someone's dignity and of their very humanity. It was a carefully constructed display of defeat. It was a form of killing that the Romans had devised to make a public statement about the person's humanity and what they stand for. Those were the things that were associated with crucifixion in the first century near Middle East. So it's no wonder that the followers of Christ struggled with Jesus telling them to pick up their crosses. Who wants to do that? And as much as we may know that theoretically, it is difficult for us to really get it because in Western culture and history, the cross has received layer over layer over layer of gold. Right? It has adorned crowns of monarchs and emperors, and it has been the centerpiece of cathedrals. It has been the justification for laws, and it has been the handle of swords. It has been an instrument of privilege and power. The problem with our use of the notion of taking up our cross is that the cross no longer is a symbol of shame in the same way. Even if we learned it at Sunday school and all, but our senses are not there, right? That's not how we feel about it. We lose the element of absurdity that was inherent to crucifixion in the first century. So if we are to have any sort of similar understanding to this, we need to strip our cross. We need to strip our cross down from its golden casting, and we need to strip it down from its association with power. I don't think we can quite get there. But even though we struggle to understand the shame of the cross because of the fame of the cross in our context, still I believe that there might be something that we have in common with those followers of Jesus of the first century. And that is the struggle to take our cross for the sake of the cross of Christ and not for our own sake. And we're back with the loop, right? Whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. And the problem, as I pointed before, is in reading and transforming this into a looping logic that is self-defeating, right? Understanding losing our life as just an alternative route for saving it anyway. Or just some sort of doctrinal formula for getting us saved. Right? In other words, we set out to do the exact same thing, which is to save our lives. And then we just try to find a more holy way around it. A more acceptable way around it. And ironically, that takes us back to where we started, right? Just trying to save ourselves, just trying to save our lives. But Jesus isn't saying, use the cross to your benefit. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, take up the cross. Now, what does that mean? Because obviously, Jesus is not expecting all his followers to get a cross and crucify themselves. That's not what they do. What does this mean? What it means that we have to actually consider the cross in the context of Jesus' life, ministry, and everything that comes. We need to dare to look at it and to contemplate the sacrifice of Christ and more as more than just a mechanism. And true, the cross was a symbol of death. But the death of Christ on the cross wasn't about a choice for death. It was about an insistence on life, an insistence even on the flourishing of life, even if that insistence would threaten the human projects of power to the extent that those in power would murder Jesus. And that's why the Gospel of Mark goes the way it does. It was dangerous for this kind of Messiah identity to be made public, because in the game of power of the world, that sort of stuff gets you killed. And it did. And as Jesus' identity becomes more and more public, the closer we are to the cross in the Gospel of Mark. Because it was about this insistence of the life of all. And it was about believing that that holy commitment to life could overcome even death. Which, of course, is something Peter couldn't get at that point. But the Christ sacrifice, and so also the Christian sacrifice, is not one that is endeared to death, but it is one that is committed to life. Right? The cross of Christ is not a mechanism. It is not a badge of honor. It is an act of service for us and also ours for others. So Jesus didn't, to say it differently, Jesus didn't die so that Jesus could rise again to fullness of life, right? To save his own life, as it were. No, he died so that life could be a gift for all. So the cross of Christ is one necessarily taken for the sake of another. The cross of Christ is one necessarily taken for the sake of another. And there's a detail in Mark's storytelling here which I find so beautiful. And that is, before rebuking Peter, Mark tells us that Jesus looks at his disciples. That he looks at his disciples. I love these looks. They're there as well, not in the Gospel of Mark. This is my mind now. When Jesus is praying in Gethsemane, take away from me this cup. And he keeps on going back to his disciples and seeing them. And then he goes to the cross. He looks at them. And that look, it says so much. No, Peter, I will not save my life if that means that their lives and your life is lost. I will lose it so that we may all live. Now, if the cross of Christ is one necessarily taken for the sake of another, so also the cross that he asks that we carry. It is the cross of grace and it is the cross of love. It is the cross of sacrifice for the sake of life. And that is why we must forfeit our own life. In the sense that it must stop being the center and the goal so that we can surrender to the encompassing, abundant life of the risen Christ. And that is a life, yes, that includes mine. And it includes mine in its eternal flourishing, but it includes it in its abundance, not in its specificity. So the cross isn't a transaction to buy our life. It is a surrender to the grace, life force of the very God. The understanding of Messiah that Peter was echoing, which was not only common to the first century Jews, but is an echo of the ways of humanity, was an understanding of being chosen by God as a project of power. But Jesus' identity as the Messiah, the one that would take them to the cross and beyond, it was not a project of power, it was a project of grace. It was not a project of gaining access to something, but of giving access to life to as many as may be. If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. Now I come back to this perceived loop after our reflection, and I wonder if we found our way out of it, if we sort of solved it. But I wonder if maybe we're not meant to solve it. If maybe the sense of confusion, of having to look intently to try to figure this out, if it's not also a bit intentional. Because it demands this constant exercise of asking, what am I looking at? What does this mean? Of looking around and trying to make sense of this, where we are and among the people and the reality that we are trying to make sense of today. So maybe rather than a self-defeating loop like the Social Security number one that I shared in the beginning, and that was a loop that got my identity lost in the process, right? But this is a questioning that helps us not get lost in our own identity. That helps us not get lost in ourselves and in our own projections of the identity of Christ and who he should be and how he should behave and whom he should save and whom he should not save and all of these things that we do. Maybe rather than a loop then, this is an insistence that life can flourish with all, for all, without having to be at the expense of any. And figuring out what that looks like in our time and place demands looking. And looking under the touch of Jesus. So maybe this apparent confusion can rather be an insistence on a project of grace and love rather than power. Which is, again, a question we need to keep asking, because these power games, they keep on taking new forms and shapes as the gospel calls us to stay alert to our temptation to always adapt the gospel to these new forms of power rather than resisting them without and within ourselves. And if I'm honest with you all, I still often find that I would like to have clear-cut answers about life and about my own identity. I'd like to have them served to me on a silver platter. But then, I don't think that's the invitation, and it's not the offer I want to go for. Again and again and again, I want to choose, I want to make a choice for following Jesus and learning to choose the love of life rather than the fear of death. The possibility of life rather than the fear of destruction. And I want to choose that for myself and all around me. So maybe that's a loop worth spending time in. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you that you may know that he is gracious towards you. May the Lord turn his face towards each and every one of you, that he may bring you of his peace. So let us go in the peace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and let us serve each other, let us serve the world, let us serve the Lord, let us do it joyfully. Amen.
Do you want to stay connected with us? Check out our website at oslointernational.church to discover more about our community, access additional resources, and join us in our faith journey. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.